mushrooms, or someone drove by and filled the whole place with bullets as I was the only mortal there, they'd just say, "Oh my, what a terrible shame. So sorry, really. It won't happen again."
"So you're saying they'd kill you?"
Susan said.
"Bianca has a grudge against me," I said. "She couldn't just sneak up to me and tear my throat out, but she could arrange for something to happen to me more indirectly. It's probably what she had in mind."
Susan frowned.
"I've seen you handle things a lot worse than those two out there," I let out a breath of exasperation.
"Yeah, maybe, sure. But what's the point in taking chances?"
"Can't you see what this might mean to me?" she said. "Harry, that footage I shot of the werewolf..."
"Loop Garou," I interrupted.
"Whatever. It was 10 seconds of footage that was only aired for 3 days before it vanished, and it put me further ahead than 5 years of legwork. If I could publish actual interviews with vampires..."
"Phew, Susan, you're reading too much off the bestseller list. In the real world, the vampire eats you before you hit the record button."
"I've taken my chances before, so have you."
"I don't go looking for trouble," I said.
Her eyes flashed.
"Damn it, Harry. How long have I been putting aside the things that happened to you? Like tonight, when I was supposed to be spending the evening with my boyfriend, and instead I'm bailing him out of jail."
"Ouch." I glanced down. "Susan, believe me, if I could have done anything else, this could be a fantastic opportunity for me."
She was right. And she had bailed me out of trouble often enough before that maybe I owed her that opportunity, dangerous as it might be. She was a big girl and could make her own choices. But damn it, I couldn't just nod my head and smile and let her walk into that kind of danger. Better to try to sidetrack her.
"No," I said. "I've got enough problems without pissing off the White Council again."
Her eyes narrowed.
"What's this White Council?
Kyle talked to you as though it were some kind of ruling body. Is it like a vampire court, only for wizards?"
"Exactly like that," I thought.
Susan hadn't gotten as far as she had by being stupid.
"Not really," I told her.
"You're a horrible liar, Harry."
"The White Council is a group of the most powerful men and women in the world, Susan. Wizards. Their big currency is in secrets, and they don't like people knowing about them."
Her eyes gleamed like a hound on a fresh scent.
"And you're some kind of ambassador for them?"
I had to laugh at the notion.
"Oh, God, no. But I'm a member. It's sort of like having a black belt. It's a mark of status, of respect. With the council, it means that I get to vote when issues come up, and that I have to abide by their rules."
"Are you entitled to represent them at a function like this?"
I didn't like the direction this conversation was headed.
Obligated to, really, in this case."
"So if you don't show up, you'll be in trouble?"
I scowled. "Not as much trouble as I'll be in if I go. The worst the council will be able to do is accuse me of being impolite. I can live with that."
"And if you do show up?"
"Come on, Harry, what's the worst that could happen?"
I threw up my hands.
"I could get myself killed, or worse. Susan, you really don't understand what you're asking of me."
I pushed myself up off the couch to go to her. Bad idea. My head swam and my vision blurred.
I would have fallen, but Susan dropped the invitation and caught me. She eased me back down to the couch, and I kept my arm around her, drawing her down to me. She felt soft and warm. We lay there for a moment, and she rubbed her cheek against the duster. Leather creaked, and I heard her sigh.
"I'm sorry, Harry. I shouldn't hit you with this right now."
"It's all right," I said.
"I just think that it's something big. If we..."
I turned a little, tangled my fingers in the dark softness of her hair, and kissed her. Her eyelids opened wide for a second, then lowered. Her words broke off into a low, growling sound, and her mouth softened beneath mine, warm and getting warmer. In spite of my aches and bruises, the kiss felt good. Felt really good. Her mouth tasted nice. The softness of her lips, mobile and eager beneath mine. I felt her slide a few fingers in between the buttons of my shirt, caressing the skin there. An electric sensation thrilled through me. Our tongues met, and I dragged her closer. She moaned again, then abruptly pushed me back enough to straddle my hips with those long and lovely legs, and began to kiss me as though she meant to inhale me. I ran my hands over her hips, lingering on the small of her back, and then she moved them, grinding against me. I moved my hands to the taut tension of her thighs and slid them up over the bare, smooth skin, lifting her skirt up, baring her legs, her hips. I faltered in surprise for a half second when I realized she wasn't wearing anything underneath. But then we'd been planning on an evening in. A spasm of need and hunger pounded through all the exhaustion, and I clutched her, felt her gasp again, willing and as hungry as me, her body tensing against me beneath my hands. She started jerking at my belt, gasping, her breath hot in my face.
"Harry, you jerk, don't you think this is going to distract me forever?"
Shortly after that, we made sure that neither of us could think of anything at all and fell asleep a goodly while after that, tangled together in a sprawl of exhausted limbs, dark hair, and soft blankets in front of the fire. All right, so the entire day wasn't a living hell. But as it turned out, hell got up awfully early in the morning. Chapter 9. I dreamed. The nightmare felt familiar, almost comfortable, though it had been years since I'd gone through it. It began in a cave, its walls made of translucent crystal, all but glowing in the dim light of the fire beneath the cauldron. The silver manacles were tied on my wrists, and I was too dizzy to keep my own balance. I looked to the left and right and watched my blood glide down over the manacles from where they pierced my wrists like thorns, then fell into a pair of earthen bowls set out beneath them. My godmother came to me, pale and breathtaking in the firelight, her hair spilling down around her like a cloud of silk. The sheathed lady was beautiful beyond the pale of mortals, her eyes bewitching, her mouth more tempting than the most luscious fruit. She kissed my bare chest. Shudders of cold pleasure ran through me. "Soon," she whispered between kisses, "only a few more nights of the dark moon, my sweetling, and you will be strong enough." She kept kissing me, and I began to lose my vision. Cold pleasure, fairy magic, coursed through her lips like a drug, so sweet that it was almost an agony of its own, and made the torment of the bonds, the blood loss, almost worthwhile. Almost. I felt myself gasping for breath and stared at the fire, focusing on it, trying to keep from falling into the darkness. The dream changed. I dreamt of fire. Someone that I had once loved like a father stood in the middle of it, screaming in agony. They were black screams, horrible screams, high-pitched and utterly without pride or dignity or humanity. In the dream, as in life, I forced myself to watch the flesh blacken and flake away from sizzling muscle and baking bone, watched muscles contract in tortured spasms while I stood there over the fire and, metaphorically speaking, blew on the coals. "Justin," I whispered. In the end, I couldn't watch any longer. I closed my eyes and bowed my head, listening to the thunder of my own heart pounding in my ears. Pounding. My heart pounding. I came out of the dream, blinking, opened my eyes. My door rattled on its frame under a series of hammering blows. Susan woke up at the same time, sitting up, the blanket we'd been curled under gliding down over the curves of her breasts. It was still dark outside. The longest candle hadn't burned away, but the fire was down to embers again. My body ached all over. The day after ache of tired joints and muscles demanding time to recuperate. I rose as the pounding went on and went to the kitchen drawer. My .38 had been lost in a battle with the gang of half-mad lycanthropes the year before, and I replaced it with the medium-barreled .357. I must have been feeling insecure that day or something. The gun weighed about 2,000 pounds in my hand. I made sure it was loaded and turned to face the door. Susan pushed her hair out of her eyes, blinking at my gun, and backed away, making damn sure she was out of my line of fire. Smart girl, Susan.
"You're not going to have much luck breaking down that door," I called out.
I didn't point the gun at the door yet.
Never point a gun at anything you aren't sure you want dead.
I replaced the original one with a steel core and a steel frame. Demons, you know.
The pounding ceased.
Dresden,
Michael called from the other side of the door.
I tried to reach you on the phone, but I must be off the hook. We've got to talk.
I frowned and put the gun back in the drawer.
Okay, okay. Sheesh, Michael. Do you know what time it is?
Time to work, he answered. The sun will be up shortly.
Lunatic, I mumbled.
Susan looked around at the remnants of our clothing scattered pretty much everywhere, and the sprawl of blankets and pillows and cushions all over the floor.
I think maybe I'll just wait in your room, she said.
Right, okay. I opened the kitchen closet and got out my heavy robe, the one I usually save for working in the lab, and slipped into it.
Stay covered up, all right? I don't want you to get sick.
She gave me a sleepy half-smile and rose. All long limbs and grace and interesting tan lines, then vanished into my little bedroom and shut the door. I walked across the room and opened the door for Michael. He stood there in blue jeans, a flannel shirt, and a fleece-lined denim jacket. He had his big gym bag slung over his shoulders, and Amarakis was a silent tension I could just barely feel within it. I looked from the bag to his face and asked, "Trouble?"
"Could be. Did you send someone to Father Fort Hill last night?"
I rubbed at my eyes, trying to get the sleep out of them.
Coffee. I needed coffee. Or a Coke. Just as long as there was caffeine somewhere. Yes, a girl named Lydia. She was worried that a ghost was after her.
He called me this morning. Something spent the night trying to get into the church. I blinked at him.
What? Did it get inside?
He shook his head.
He didn't have time to tell me much. Can you come down there with me and take a look around?
I nodded and stepped back from the door. Give me a couple minutes. I headed for the icebox and got out a can of Coke. My fingers worked enough to open it, at least, though they still felt stiff. My stomach reminded me that I'd been ignoring it, and I got out a plate of cold cuts while I was there. I swigged the Coke and made myself a big sandwich. I looked up a minute later to see Michael eyeing the destruction that had been the living room. He nudged one of Susan's shoes with his foot and glanced up at me apologetically.
I'm sorry. I didn't know anyone was here.
It's okay. Michael smiled briefly, then nodded. Well, do I need to lecture you on sexual involvement before marriage? I growled something about early morning and inconvenient visitors and toads. Michael only shook his head, smiling, while I wolfed down food.
Did you tell her?
Tell her what?
He lifted an eyebrow at me. I rolled my eyes.
Almost.
You almost told her.
Sure. Got distracted.
Michael nudged Susan's other shoe with his foot and let out a delicate cough.
So I see.
I finished the sandwich and part of the Coke, then walked across the room and slipped into the bedroom. The room was freezing, and I could see Susan curled into a ball beneath the heavy blankets on my bed. Mister had lain down with his back against hers and watched me with sleepy, self-satisfied eyes as I came in.
Rub it in, fuzzball, I growled at him and dressed quickly.
Socks, jeans, T-shirt, heavy flannel work shirt over that. Mom's amulet around my neck and a little silver charm bracelet with a half a dozen shields dangling off it, fixed to my left wrist in place of the charm I'd given to Lydia. A plain silver ring, its interior surface inscribed with a number of runes, went onto my right hand. Both pieces of jewelry tingled with the enchantments I'd laid on them, still fairly fresh. I leaned over the bed and kissed Susan's cheek. She made a sleepy, murmuring sound and snuggled a little deeper beneath the covers. I thought about getting under there with her and making sure she was nice and warm before leaving, but instead went out, shutting the door carefully behind me. Michael and I left, piling into his truck, a white, of course, Ford pickup with extra wheels and enough hauling power to move mountains, and headed for St. Mary of the Angels. St. Mary of the Angels is a big church. I mean, a big church. It's been looming over the Wicker Park area for more than 80 years, and has seen the neighborhood grow from a collection of cheap homes for immigrants mixed in with rich folks' mansions to little Bohemia today. Packed with yuppies and artsies, success stories and wannabes. The church, I'm told, is modeled after St. Peter's Basilica in Rome,
which is to say enormous and elegant and maybe a bit overdone. It takes up an entire city block. I mean, sheesh. The sun came up as we entered the parking lot. I felt the golden rays slice across the morning skies, the sudden, subtle shift of forces playing about the world. Dawn is significant, magically speaking. It's a time of new beginnings. Magic isn't as simple as good and evil, light and dark. But there's a lot of correlations between the powers particular to night and the use of black magic. We drove around to the rear parking lot of the church and got out of the truck. Michael walked in front of me carrying his bag. I stuffed my hands down in the pockets of my duster as I followed him. I felt uncomfortable approaching the church, not for any weirdo quasi-mystical reason, just because I've never felt comfortable with churches in general. The church had killed a lot of wizards in its day, believing them in league with Satan. It felt strange just to be strolling up on business. "Hi, God, it's me, Harry. Please don't turn me into a pillar of salt." "Harry," Michael said, bringing me out of my reverie. "Look." He had stopped beside a pair of worn old cars parked in the back lot. Someone had done one hell of a job on them. The windows had all been smashed, their safety glass fractured and dented. The hoods were dented as well. The headlights lay mostly on the ground in front of the cars, and all the tires were flat. I walked around to the back of the cars, frowning. The taillights lay shattered on the ground. The antenna had been torn off each car and were not in sight. Long scratches in three parallel rows ran down the sides of both cars. "Well?" Michael asked me. I looked up at him and shrugged. "Probably something got frustrated when it couldn't get inside the church," he snorted. "Do you think?" He adjusted the gym bag until Amaracus's handle lay jutting outside the zipper. "Any chances that's still around?" I shook my head. "I doubt it. Come daylight, ghosts usually head back to the Never Never."
"Usually?"
"Usually. Almost without exception." Michael eyed me and kept one hand on the hilt of his sword. We walked on up to the delivery door. Compared to the grandeur of the church's front, it looked stunningly modest. On either side of the double doors, someone had gone to the trouble to plant and care for a half dozen rose bushes. Someone else had gone to a lot of trouble to tear them into shreds. Each plant had been uprooted. Thorny branches lay strewn across several dozen square yards around the door. I crouched down beside several fallen branches, picking them up one at a time, squinting at them in the dawn dimness.
"What are you looking for?" Michael asked me.
"Blood on the thorns," I said. "Rose thorns can poke little holes in just about anything. And something that tore them up this hard would have been scratching itself on them."
"Any blood?"
"No. No footprints in the earth, either." Michael nodded.
"A ghost, then."
I squinted up at Michael. "I hope not." He tilted his head and frowned at me. I dropped a branch and spread my hands. "A ghost can usually only manage to move things physically in bursts, throwing pots and pans, maybe really stretch things and stack up a bunch of books or something." I gestured at the torn plants and then back toward the wrecked cars. "Not only that, but it's limited to a certain place, time, or event. The ghost, if it is one, followed Lydia here and rampaged around on blessed ground, tearing things apart. I mean, wow. This thing is way stronger than any ghost I've ever heard of." Michael's frown deepened.
"What are you saying, Harry?"
"I'm saying that we might be getting out of our depth here. Look, Michael, I know a lot about spooks and nasties, but they aren't really my specialty or anything." He frowned at me. "We might need to know more." I stood up, brushing myself off.
"That," I said, "is my specialty. Let's talk to Father Fordhill."
Michael knocked on the door. It opened at once. Father Fordhill, a graying man of slight build and only medium stature, blinked anxiously up at us through a pair of wire-rimmed spectacles. His eyes were normally a shade of blue so bright as to rival robin's eggs, but today they were heavily underlined, shadowed.
"Oh," he said. "Oh, Michael. Thank the Lord."
He opened the door wider, and Michael stepped over the threshold. The two embraced. Fordhill kissed Michael on either cheek and stepped back to peer at me. "And Harry Dresden, professional wizard. I've never had anyone ask me to bless a 5-gallon drum into holy water before, Mr. Dresden. Michael peered at me, evidently surprised that the priest and I knew each other. I shrugged, a little embarrassed, and said, "He told me I could count on him in a pinch." "And so you can," Forthill said, his blue eyes sparkling for a moment behind the spectacles. "I trust you have no complaints about the blessed water." "None at all," I said. "Talk about your surprised ghouls." "Harry," Michael chided, "you've been keeping secrets again." "Contrary to what Charity thinks, Michael, I don't go running to the phone to call you every time I have a little problem." I clapped Michael on the shoulder in passing and offered my hand to Father Forthill, who shook it gravely, no hug and kiss on each cheek for me. Forthill smiled up at me. "I look forward to the day when you give your life to God, Mr. Dresden. He can use men with your courage." I tried to smile, but it probably looked a little sickly. "Look, Father, I'd love to talk about it with you sometime, but we're here for a reason." "Indeed," Forthill said. The sparkle in his eyes faded, and his manner became absolutely serious. He began to walk down a clean hallway with dark, heavy beams of old wood overhanging it and paintings of the saints on the walls. We kept pace with him. "The young woman arrived yesterday, just before sunset." "Was she all right?" I asked. He lifted both eyebrows. "All right? I should say not. All the signs of an abused personality. Borderline malnutrition. She had a low-grade fever as well and hadn't bathed recently. She looked as though she might be going through withdrawal or something." I frowned. "Yeah, she looked like she was in pretty bad shape." I briefly recounted my conversation with Lydia and my decision to help her. Father Forthill shook his head. "I provided fresh clothes and a meal for her and was getting set to put her to bed on a spare cot in the back of the rectory. That's when it happened." "What happened?" "She began to shake," Forthill said. "Her eyes rolled back into her head. She was still sitting at the dinner table, and spilled her soup onto the floor. I thought she was having a seizure of some sort, and tried to hold her down, and to get something into her mouth, to keep her from biting her tongue." He sighed, clasped his hands behind his back as he walked. "I'm afraid I was of little help to the poor child. The fit seemed to pass in a few moments, but she still trembled, and had gone absolutely pale." "Cassandra's tears," I said. "Or narcotic withdrawal," Forthill said. "Either way, she needed help. I moved her to the cot. She begged me not to leave her, so I sat down and began to read part of St. Matthew's Gospel to her. She seemed to calm somewhat, but she had such a look in her eyes." The old priest sighed. "That resolved look that they get when they're sure that they're lost. Despair. And in one so young." "When did the attack begin?" I asked. "About 10 minutes later," the priest said. "It started with the most terrible howling of wind. Lord preserve me, but I was sure the windows would rattle out of their frames. When we started to hear sounds outside," he swallowed, "terrible sounds. Something walking back and forth, heavy footsteps. And then it started calling her name." The priest folded his arms and rubbed his palms against either arm. "I rose and addressed the being, and asked its name, but it only laughed at me. I began to compel it by the holy word, and it went quite mad. I could hear it crushing things outside. I don't mind telling you that it was quite the most terrifying experience I've ever had in my life. The girl tried to leave, to go out to it. She said that she didn't want me harming myself, that it would only find her in any case. Well, I forbade her, of course, and refused to let her past me. It kept on outside, and I kept reading the word aloud to the girl. It waited outside. I could feel it, but could see nothing outside the windows. Such a darkness. Every so often it would destroy something else, and we'd hear the sound of it. After several hours, it seemed to grow quiet. The girl went to sleep. I walked the halls to make sure all the doors and windows were still closed. And when I came back, she was gone."
"Gone?" I asked. "Gone as in left, or as in just gone?"
Forthill gave me a smile that looked a bit shaky. "The back door was unlocked, though she'd shut it after herself." The older man shook his head. "I called Michael at once, of course."
We've got to find that girl, I said.
Forthill shook his head, his expression grave. Mr. Dresden, I am certain that only the power of the Almighty kept us safe within these walls last night.
I won't argue with you, Father, but if you could have sensed this creature's anger, its rage. Mr. Dresden, I would not wish to encounter this being outside of a church without seeking God's help in the matter.
I jerked a thumb at Michael. I did seek God's help. Heck, is one Knight of the Cross not enough? I could always put out a bat signal for the other two.
Forthill smiled. That's not what I meant, and you know it. But as you wish, you must come to your own decision. He turned to Michael and me both and said, I hope, gentlemen, that I can trust your discretion on this matter. The police report will doubtless reflect that persons unknown perpetuated the vandalism. I snorted.
A little white lie, Father.
I felt bad the minute I said it, but heck, I get tired of the conversion efforts every time I show up.
Evil gains power from fear, Mr. Dresden, Forthill replied. Within the church, we have agencies for dealing with these matters. He put a hand on Michael's shoulder briefly. But spreading the word of it to everyone, even to all of the brethren, would accomplish nothing but to frighten many people and to make the enemy that much more able to do harm. I nodded at the priest.
I like that attitude, Father. You almost sound like a wizard.
His eyebrows shot up, but then he broke into a quiet, weary laugh.
Be careful, both of you, and may God go with you. He made a sign of the cross over both of us, and I felt this quiet stirring of power, just as I sometimes did around Michael.
Faith.
Michael and Forthill exchanged a few quiet words about Michael's family while I lurked in the background.
Forthill arranged to christen the new baby whenever Charity delivered. They exchanged hugs again.
Forthill shook my hand, businesslike and friendly, and we left.
Outside, Michael watched me as we walked back to his truck.
Well, he asked, what's next?
The sun was higher now, painting the sky blue, the clouds white. I know someone who's pretty close to the spooks around here. That psychic in Old Town.
Michael scowled and spat.
The necromancer.
I snorted.
He's no necromancer. He can barely call up a ghost and talk to it. He's got to fake it most of the time.
Besides, had he been a real necromancer, the White Council would have already hounded him down and beheaded him. Doubtless the man I was thinking of had already been visited by at least one warden and warned of the consequences of dabbling too much into the dark arts.
If he's so inept, why speak to him at all?
He's probably closer to the spirit world than anybody else in town. Other than me, I mean. I'll send out Bob, too, and see what kind of information he can run down. We're bound to have different contacts.
Michael frowned at me. I don't trust this business of communing with spirits, Harry. If Father Forthill and the others knew about this familiar of yours...
Bob isn't a familiar, I shot back.
He performs the same function, doesn't he? I snorted.
Familiars work for free. I gotta pay Bob.
Pay him?
He asked, his tone suspicious.
Pay what?
Mostly romance novels. Sometimes I splurge on a...
Michael looked pained. Harry, I really don't want to know. Isn't there some way that you can work out some kind of spell here, instead of relying on these unholy beings?
I sighed and shook my head.
Sorry, Michael. If it was a demon, it would have left footprints, and maybe some kind of psychic trail I could follow. But I'm pretty sure this was a pure spirit, and a goddamn strong one.
Harry... Michael said, voice stern.
Sorry, I forgot. Ghosts don't usually inhabit a construct, a magical body. They're just energy. They don't leave any physical traces behind, at least none that last for hours at a time. If it was here, I could tell you all kinds of things about it, probably, and work magic on it directly. But it's not here, so...
Michael sighed. Very well. I will put out the word to those I know to be on the lookout for the girl.
Lydia, he said her name was.
Yeah,
I described her to Michael. And she has a charm on her wrist, the one I'd been wearing the past few nights.
Would it protect her?
Michael asked.
I shrugged.
From something as mean as this sounded?
I don't know.
We've got to find out who this ghost was when it was alive and shut it down.
Which still will not tell us who or what is stirring up the spirits in the city.
Michael unlocked his truck and we got inside.
That's what I like about you, Michael. You're always thinking so positively.
He grinned at me. Faith, Harry. God has a way of seeing to it that things fall into place. He started driving, and I leaned back in my seat and closed my eyes. First off to see the psychic, then to send Bob out to find out more about what looked to be the most dangerous ghost I'd seen in a long time. And then to keep on looking for whoever was behind all the spooky goings-on and rap them politely on the head until they stopped. Easy as 1, 2, 3.
Sure.
I whimpered, slunk down in my seat a little more, and wished I had kept my aching, sore self in bed. Chapter 10. Mortimer Lindquist had tried to give his house that gothic feel. Grayish gargoyles stood at the corners of his roof. Black iron gates glowered at the front of his house, and statuary lined the walk to his front door. Long grass had overgrown his yard. If his house hadn't been a red-roofed, white-walled stucco transplant from somewhere in South California, it might have worked. The results looked more like the haunted mansion at Disneyland than an ominous abode of a speaker to the dead. The black iron gates stood surrounded by plain chain-link fence. The gargoyles, on closer inspection, proved to be plastic reproductions. The statuary, too, had the rough outlines of plaster rather than the clean, sweeping profile of marble. You could have plopped a pink flamingo right down in the middle of the unmowed weeds, and it would have somehow matched the decor. But I suppose at night, with the right lighting and the right attitude, some people might have believed it. I shook my head and lifted my hands to rap on the door. It opened before my knuckles touched it, and a well-rounded set of shoulders below a shining, balding head backed through the doorway, grunting. I stepped to one side. The little man tugged an enormous suitcase out onto the porch, never taking notice of me, his florid face streaked with perspiration. I sidled to the doorway as he turned to lug the bag out of the gate, muttering to himself under his breath. I shook my head and went on into the house. The door was a business entrance. There was no tingling sensation of crossing the threshold of a dwelling uninvited. The front room reminded me of the house's exterior. Lots of black curtains draped down over the walls and doorways. Red and black candles squatted all over the place. A grinning human skull leered from a bookshelf straining to contain copies of the Encyclopedia Britannica with the lettering scraped off their spines. The skull was plastic, too. Morty had a table set up in the room, several chairs around it with a high-backed chair at the rear. The wood had actually been carved with a number of monstrous beings. I took a seat in the chair, folded my hands on the table in front of me, and waited. The little man came back in, wiping his face with a bandana handkerchief, sweating and panting. "Shut the door," I said. "We need to talk, Morty." He squealed and whirled around.
"You!" he stammered. "Dresden, what are you doing here?"
I glared at him. "Come in, Marty." He came closer and left the door open. In spite of his pudginess, he moved with the nervous energy of a spooked cat. His white business shirt showed stains beneath his arms, reaching halfway to his belt.
"Look, Dresden, I told you guys before. I get the rules, right? I haven't been doing anything you guys talked about."
Ha ha. The White Council had sent someone to see him. Morty was a professional con. I hadn't planned on getting any honest answers out of him without a lot of effort. Maybe I could play this angle and save myself a lot of work. "Let me tell you something, Morty. When I come into a place and don't say a thing except, 'Let's talk,' and the first thing I hear is, 'I didn't do it,' it makes me think that the person I'm talking to must have done something. You know what I'm saying?" His florid face lost several shades of red.
"No way, man. Look, I got nothing to do with what's been going on. Not my fault, none of my business, man."
"With what's been going on," I said. I looked down at my folded hands for a moment and then back up at him. "What's the suitcase for, Morty? You do something that means you gotta leave town for a while?" He swallowed, thick neck working.
"Look, Dresden, Mr. Dresden, my sister got sick, see, and I just have to help her out."
"Sure you are," I said. "That's what you're doing. Going out of town is help your sick sister."
"I swear to God," Morty said, lifting his hand, his face earnest.
I pointed at the chair across from me. "Sit down, Morty."
"I'd like to, but I've got a cab coming,"
He turned toward the door.
Vinta servitas,
I hissed, nice and dramatic, and threw some will at the door. Sudden wind slammed it shut right in front of his eyes. He squeaked and backed up several paces, staring at the door, then whirled to face me. I used the remnants of the same spell to push out a chair opposite me. Sit down, Morty. I've got a few questions. Now, if you cut the crap, you'll make your cab. And if not, I left the words hanging. One thing about intimidation is that people can always think of something worse than you could do to them than you can, if you leave their imagination some room to play. He stared at me and swallowed again, his jowls jiggling. Then he moved to the chair as though he expected chains to fly out of it and tie him down the moment he sat. He balanced his weight on the very edge of the chair, licked his lips, and watched me, probably trying to figure out the best lies for the questions he expected. "You know," I said, "I've read your books, Morty. Ghosts of Chicago, The Spook Factor, two or three others. You did good work there." His expression changed, eyes narrowing in suspicion. "Thank you." "I mean, 20 years ago, you were a pretty damn good investigator. Sensitivity to spiritual energies and apparitions, ghosts, what we call a ectomancer in the business." "Yeah," he said. His eyes softened a little, if not his voice. He avoided looking directly in my face. Most people do. "That was a long time ago." I kept my voice in the same tone, the same expression. "And now you run seances for people. How many times do people actually get to contact a spirit? 1 time in 10? 1 in 20? Must be a real letdown from the actual stuff. Play acting, I mean." He was good at covering his expressions, I'll give him that. But I'm used to watching people. I saw anger in the way he held his neck and shoulders. "I provide a legitimate service to people in need." "No, you play on their grief to take them for all you can. You don't believe that you're doing right, Morty, deep down. You can justify it any way you want, but you don't like what you're doing. If you did, your powers wouldn't have faded away like they have." His jaw set in a hard line, and he didn't hide the anger anymore, the first honest reaction I'd seen out of him since he cried out in surprise. "If you've got a point, Dresden, get to it. I've got a plane to catch." I spread my fingers over the tabletop. "In the past 2 weeks," I said, "the spooks have been going mad. You should see the troubles they've caused. That poltergeist in the Campbell house, the basement beast of UFC, Agatha Hagglethorne down at Cook County." Morty grimaced and wiped at his face again. "Yeah, I hear things. You and that Knight of the Sword have been covering the worst of it." "What else has been happening, Morty? I'm getting a little cranky losing sleep, so keep it short and simple." "I don't know," he said, sullen. "I've lost my powers, remember?" I narrowed my eyes. "But you hear things, Morty. You've still got some sources in the Never Never. Why are you leaving town?" He laughed, and it had a shaky edge to it. "You said you read all of my books? Did you read They Shall Rise?" I glanced over it. End of the world type stuff. I figured you'd been talking to the wrong kind of spirits too much. They love trying to sell people on Armageddon. A lot of them are cons like you. He ignored me. "Then you read my theory on the barrier between our world and the Never Never, that it is slowly being torn away?
And you think it's falling to pieces now? Morty, that wall has been there since the dawn of time. I don't think it's going to collapse right now."
"Wall," he said with a sneer. "More like saran wrap, wizard, like jello. It bends and wiggles and stirs." He rubbed his palms on his thighs, shivering. "And it's falling now?"
"Look around you," he shouted.
"Good God, wizard. The past 2 weeks, the border's been wagging back and forth like a hooker at a dock workers' convention. Why the hell do you think all of these ghosts have been rising?"
I didn't let the sudden volume of his tone make me blink. "You're saying that this instability has been making it easier for ghosts to cross over from the Never Never?"
"And easier to form bigger, stronger ghosts when people die," he said. "You think you've got some pissed-off ghosts now? Wait until some honor student on her way out of the South Side with a college scholarship gets popped by accident in a gang shootout. Wait until some poor sap who got AIDS from a blood transfusion breathes his last."
bigger, badder ghosts, I said. Super ghosts. That's what you're talking about. He laughed, a nasty little laugh. New generation of viruses is coming, too. Things are going to hell all over. Eventually, that border's going to get thin enough to spit through, and then you'll have more problems with demon attacks than gang violence. I shook my head. All right, I said. Let's say that I buy that the barrier is fluid rather than concrete. There's turbulence in it, and it's making crossing over easier, both ways. Could something be causing the turbulence?
How the hell should I know? He snarled. You don't know what it's like, Dresden, to speak to things that exist in the past and in the future, as well as in the now. To have them walk up to you in the salad bar and start telling you how they murdered their wife in their sleep. I mean, you think you've got a hold on things, that you understand, but in the end, it all falls to pieces. A con is simpler, Dresden. You make order. People don't give a flying fuck if Uncle Jeffrey really forgives them for missing his last birthday party. They want to know that the world is a place where Uncle Jeffrey can and should forgive them.
He swallowed and looked around the room at the fake tomes and the fake skull.
That's what I'm selling them. Closure. Like on television. They want to know that it's all going to work out in the end, and they're happy to pay for it.
A car honked outside. Morty glared at me. We're through. I nodded. He jerked to his feet, splotches of color in his cheeks.
God, I need a drink. Get out of town, Dresden. Something came across last night like nothing I've ever felt.
I thought of ruined cars and rose bushes planted on consecrated ground. Do you know what it is?
It's big, Morty said, and it's pissed off. It's going to start killing, Dresden, and I don't think you or anyone else is going to be able to stop it.
But it's a ghost. He gave me a smile that showed me his canines. He was creepy on that florid, eyes-too-wide face.
It's a nightmare.
He started to turn away. I wanted to let him go, but I couldn't. The man had become a liar, a sniveling con, but he hadn't always been. I rose to beat him to the door, taking his arm in one hand. He spun to face me, jerking his arm away, glaring defiantly at my eyes. I avoided locking glares. I didn't want to look at Mortimer Lindquist's soul.
Morty, I said quietly, get away from your seances for a while. Go somewhere quiet. Read. Relax. You're older now, stronger. If you give yourself a chance, the power will come back.
He laughed again, tired and jaded.
Sure, Dresden, just like that.
Morty. He turned away from me and stalked out the door. He didn't bother to lock the place up behind him. I watched him head out to the cab, which waited by the curb. He lugged his bag into the back seat and then followed it.
Before the cab pulled out, he rolled down the window. Dresden, he called. Under my chair there's a drawer. My notes. If you want to kill yourself trying to stand up to this thing, you might as well know what you're getting into.
He rolled the window back up as the cab pulled away. I watched it go, then went back inside. I found the drawer hidden in the base of a carved wooden chair, and inside I found a trio of old, leather-bound journals. Vellum pages, covered in script that started out neat in the oldest one and became a jerky scrawl in the most recent entries. I held the books up to my mouth and inhaled the smell of leather, ink, paper, musty and genuine and real. Morty hadn't had to give me the notes. Maybe there was some root of the person he had been, deep down somewhere, that wasn't dead yet. Maybe I'd done him a little good with that advice. I'd like to think that. I blew out a breath, found a phone, and called a cab of my own. I needed to get the Beetle out of the impound if I could. Maybe Murphy could fix it for me. I gathered the journals and went to the porch to wait for the cab, shutting the door behind me. Something big was coming through town, Morty had said. A nightmare, I said out loud. Could Mort be right? Could the barrier between the spirit world and our own be falling apart? The thought made me shudder. Something had been formed. Something big and mean. And my gut instinct told me that it had a purpose. All power, no matter how terrible or benign, whether its wielder is aware of it or not, has a purpose. So this nightmare was here for something. I wondered what it wanted, wondered what it would do, and worried that all too soon I would find out.
Chapter 11. An unmarked car sat in my driveway with two nondescript men inside. I got out of the taxi, paid off the cabbie, and nodded at the driver of the car, Detective Rudolph. Rudy's clean-cut good looks hadn't faded in the year since he started with special investigations. Chicago's unspoken answer to the officially unacknowledged world of the supernatural. But the time had hardened him a bit, made him a little less white around the eyes. Rudolph nodded back, not even trying to hide his glower. He didn't like me. Maybe it had something to do with a bust several months back. Rudy had cut and run rather than stick it out next to me. Before that, I'd escaped police custody while he was supposed to be watching me. I'd had a darn good reason to escape, and it wasn't really fair of him to hold it against me, but hey, whatever got him through the day. "Hey, a detective," I said. "What's up?" "Get in the car," Rudolph said. I planted my feet and shoved my hands in my pockets with a certain nonchalance. "Am I under arrest?" Rudolph narrowed his eyes and started to speak again, but the man in the passenger seat cut him off. "Hey, Harry," Detective Sergeant John Stallings said, nodding at me. "How you doing, John? What brings you out today?" "Murph wanted us to ask you down to a scene." He reached and scratched a several days' worth of unshaven beard beneath a bad haircut and intelligent dark eyes. "Hope you got the time. We tried at your office, but you haven't been in, so she sent us down here to wait for you." I shifted Mort Lindquist's books in my arms. "I'm busy today. Can I wait?" Rudolph spat. "The lieutenant says she wants you down there now. Get your ass down there, now." Stallings gave Rudolph a look, then rolled his eyes for my benefit. "Look, Harry, Murphy told me to tell you that this one is personal." I frowned. "Personal, huh?" He spread his hands. "It's what she said." He frowned and then added, "It's Mickey Malone." I got a sickly little feeling in my stomach. "Dead?" Stallings' jaw twitched. "You better come and see for yourself." I closed my eyes and tried not to get frustrated. I didn't have time for detours. It would take me hours to grind through Mort's notes, and sundown, when the spirits would be able to cross over from the never-never, would come swiftly. But Murphy did plenty for me. I owed her. She'd saved my life a couple of times, and vice versa. She was my main source of income, too. Karen Murphy headed up Special Investigations, a post that had traditionally resulted in a couple of months of bumbling and then a speedy exit from the police force. Murphy hadn't bumbled. Instead, she'd hired the services of Chicago's only professional wizard as a consultant. She was getting to where she had a pretty good grasp on the local preternatural predators, at least the most common of them. But when things got hairy, she still called me in. Technically, I showed up on the paperwork as an investigative consultant. I guess the computer records system doesn't have numerical codes for demon banishment, divination spells, or exorcisms. S.I. had gone toe-to-toe with one of the worst things anyone but a wizard like me was ever likely to see. Only a year before, a half-ton of undestructible loup-garou. They'd taken some serious casualties, 6 dead, including Murphy's partner. Mickey Malone had gotten hamstrung. He'd gone through therapy and had come along for one last job when Michael and I took down that demon-summoning sorcerer. After that, though, he decided that his limp was going to keep him from being a good cop and retired on disability. I felt guilty for that. Maybe irrational, true, but if I'd been a little smarter or faster, maybe I could have saved those people's lives. Maybe I could have saved Mickey's health. No one else saw it that way, but I did. "All right," I said. "Give me a second to put these away." The ride was quiet except for a little meaningless chatter from Stallings. Rudolph ignored me. I closed my eyes and ached along the way. Rudolph's radio squawked and then fell abruptly silent. I could smell burnt rubber or something, and I knew it was likely my fault. I opened one eye and saw Rudolph scowling back at me in the mirror. I half-smiled and closed my eyes again. Jerk. The car stopped in a residential neighborhood near West Armitage, down in Bucktown. The district had gotten its name from the number of immigrant homes once there, and the goats kept in people's front yards. The homes had been tiny affairs, stuffed with two large families and children. Bucktown had been lived in for a century, and it was all grown up, literally. The houses, on their tiny lots, hadn't had much room to expand out, so they'd grown up instead,
giving the neighborhood a stretched, elongated look. The trees were ancient oaks and sycamores and decorated the tiny yards in stately majesty, except where they'd been roughly hacked back from the power lines and rooftops. Shadows fell in sharp slants from all the tall trees and tall houses, turning the streets and sidewalks into candy canes of light and darkness. One of the houses, a two-story white-on-white number, had its small driveway full and another half-dozen cars parked out on the street, plus Murphy's motorcycle leaning on its kickstand in the front yard. Rudolph pulled the car up alongside the curb across the street from that house and killed the engine. It went on rattling and coughing for a moment before it died. I got out of the car and felt something wrong. An uneasy feeling ran over me, prickles of sensation along the nape of my neck and against my spine. I stood there for a moment, frowning, while Rudolph and Stallings got out of the car. I looked around the neighborhood, trying to pin down the source of the odd sensations. The leaves in the trees, all in their autumn motley, rustled and sighed in the wind, occasionally falling. Dried leaves rattled and scraped over the streets. Cars drove by in the distance. A jet rumbled overhead, a deep and distant sound.
"Dresden," Rudolph snapped. "Let's go."
I lifted a hand, extended my senses out, pushing my perception out along with my will. "Hang on a second," I said. "I need to..." I quit trying to speak and searched for the source of the sensation. What the hell was it?
"Fuck it, showboat," Rudolph growled. I heard him start toward me.
"Hang on, kid," Stallings said. "Let the man work. We've both seen what he can do."
"I haven't seen shit that can't be explained," Rudolph growled, but he stayed put.
I drifted across the street to the yard of the house in question and found the first body in the fallen leaves, 5 feet to my left. A small yellow and white furred cat lay there, twisted so that its forelegs faced one way, its hindquarters the opposite. Something had broken its neck. I felt a pang of nausea. Death isn't ever pretty, really. It's worse with people, but with the animals that are close to mankind, it seems to be a little nastier than it might have been elsewhere in the wild kingdom. The cat couldn't have reached its full growth yet. Maybe a kitten from early in the spring, roaming the neighborhood. There was no collar on its neck. I could feel a little cloud of disturbance around it, a kind of psychic energy left by the traumatic, agonizing, and torturous events. But this one little thing, one animal's death, shouldn't have been enough to make me aware of it all the way over from my seat in the police car. 5 feet further on, I found a dead bird. I found its wings in two more places, then two more birds without heads. Then something that had been small and furry, and was now small and furry and squishy. Maybe a vole or a ground squirrel. And there were more. A lot more. All in all, maybe a dozen dead animals in the front yard. A dozen little patches of violent energies still lingering. No single one of them would have been enough to disturb my wizard senses, but all of them together had. So what the hell had been killing these animals? I rubbed my palms over my arms, a sickly little feeling of dread rolling through me. I looked up to see Rudolph and Stallings following me around. Their faces looked kind of greenish.
"Jesus," Stallings said. He prod the body of the cat with one toe. "What did this?"
I shook my head and rolled my shoulders in a shrug. "It might take me a while to find out. Where's Mickey?"
"Inside."
"Well then," I said and stood up, brushing off my hands. "Let's go."
Chapter 12.
I stopped outside the doorway. Mickey Malone owned a nice house. His wife taught elementary school. They wouldn't have been able to afford the place on his salary alone, but together they managed. The hardwood floors gleamed with polish. I saw an original painting, a seascape, hanging on one of the walls of the living room, adjacent to the entryway. There were a lot of plants, a lot of greenery that, along with the wood grain of the floors, gave the place a rich, organic glow. It was one of those places that wasn't just a house. It was a home.
"Come on, Dresden," Rudolph snapped. "The lieutenant's waiting."
"Is Mrs. Malone here?" I asked.
"Yes." Go get her. I need her to invite me in.
What?
Rudolph said. Give me a break. Who are you, Count Dracula? Dracul is still in Eastern Europe last time we checked, I replied. But I need her or Mickey to ask me in if you want me to do anything for you.
What the hell are you talking about?
I sighed. Look, homes, places that people live in and love and have built a life in, have a kind of a power of their own. If a bunch of strangers had been trooping in and out all day, I wouldn't have any trouble with the threshold. But you're not. You guys are friends. Like Murphy had said, this one was personal. Stallings frowned. So you can't come in? Oh, I could come in, I said, but I'd be leaving most of what I can do at the door. The threshold would mess with me being able to work with any forces in the house.
What shit? Rudolph snorted. Count Dracula.
Harry, Stallings said. Can't we invite you in?
No. Has to be someone who lives here. Besides, it's polite, I said. I don't like to go to places where I'm not welcome. I'd feel a lot better if I knew it was all right with Mrs. Malone for me to be here.
Rudolph opened his mouth to spit venom at me once again, but Stallings cut him off.
Just do it, Rudy. Go get Sonia and bring her back here.
Rudolph glowered, but did what he was told, going into the house. Stallings tapped out a cigarette and lit it. He puffed for a second thoughtfully.
So, you can't do magic inside a house unless someone asks you in.
Not a house, I said. A home. There's a difference.
So, what about Victor Sell's place?
I hear you took him on, right? I shook my head. He screwed up his threshold. He was running his business out of it, using the place for dark ceremonies. It wasn't a home anymore.
So you can't mess with anything on its own turf?
Can't mess with mortals, no. Monsters don't get a threshold.
Why not?
How the hell should I know? I said. They just don't. I can't know everything, right?
Guess so, Stallings said. After a minute, he nodded.
Sure, I see what you mean.
So it shuts you down?
Not completely, but it makes it a lot harder to do anything. It's like wearing a lead suit. That's why vampires have to keep out. Other nasties like that. If you give them that much of a handicap, they have trouble just staying alive, much less using any freaky powers.
Stallings shook his head.
This magic crap. I never would have believed it before I came here. I still have trouble with it.
Yeah? That's good. Means you aren't running into it too much.
He blew out twin columns of smoke from his nostrils.
Could be changing. Last couple of days, we've had some people go missing.
Bums, street people, folks some of the cops and detectives know. I frowned.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's all rumors so far. And people like that, they can just be gone the next day. But since I started working SI, stuff like that makes me nervous. I frowned and debated telling Stallings what I knew about Bianca's party. Doubtless there would be a whole flock of vampires in from out of town for the event. Maybe she and her flunkies were rounding up hors d'oeuvres. But I had no proof of that. For all I knew, the disappearances, if they were disappearances, could be related to turbulence in the Never Never. If so, the cops couldn't do anything about it. And if it was something else, I could be starting a very nasty exchange with Bianca. I didn't want to sick the cops on her for no reason. I'm pretty sure Bianca had the resources to send them back at me, and she could probably make it look as if I'd done something to deserve it, too.
Besides that, in the circles of the supernatural community, an old-world code of conduct still ruled. When you have a problem, you settle it face-to-face within the circle. You don't bring in the cops or the other mortals as weapons. They're the nuclear missiles of the supernatural world. If you show people a supernatural brawl is going on, it's going to scare the snot out of them, and the next thing you know, they're burning everything and everyone in sight. Most people wouldn't care that one scary guy might have been right and the other was wrong. Both guys are scary, so you ace them both and sleep better at night. It had been that way since the dawn of the Age of Reason and the rising power of mortal kind. And more power to the people, I say. I hated all these bullies, vampires, demons, other bloodthirsty old deities rampaging around like they still ruled the world. Never mind that, until a few centuries ago they really had. In any case, I decided to keep my mouth shut about Bianca's gathering until I knew enough to be certain, either way. Stallings and I made small talk.